Stephen Greenblatt's new book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, investigates how the Adam and Eve story has shaped Western culture and how we, in turn, have shaped it. As Greenblatt points out, though the story has absorbed readers for thousands of years, it's little more than a page out of 1,000 in the King James Bible. Greenblatt explores how the Adam and Eve story has resonated with different peoples in different time periods and how our embroideries of the text have shaped our concept of the world. Greenblatt is the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award-winning author of The Swerve and Will in the World, and is the John Cogan University Professor of the Humanities at Harvard. It is a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Greenblatt to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Again, the name of the book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. What got you wanting to explore the story in such detail?
Well, the answer is a fairly simple one. It's the greatest story that I know, the greatest story in our culture in terms of its power, in terms of its influence on our world, and I became fascinated by why this very, very short story, full of problems and tricky turns, should have acquired this immense force.
When do we start to see it emerge as such a force?
It actually emerged, we don't know, of course, when it was originally made its first appearance in the world, but it probably was written down in the 5th century of the before the Common Era. And it's very interesting that the Hebrews decided to begin their sacred book, the book of Genesis, with that story rather than with the story of Abraham, who's the first Jew, but instead to begin with the first humans. But still, the story probably didn't have the compelling power that it subsequently acquired until the Christians decided to embrace it. It became a kind of central Christian story. It functions in important ways for the Jews as well as for Muslims, but it really is in Christianity that it took its central role.
You take that story, you make this point, you take that story, that 1.5 pages, you don't see the word sin, you don't see the word Satan, you don't even see the word apple.
That's true. No one makes clear in that story what the talking snake is doing, why he's doing such a thing, trying to urge the woman, in this case, to eat the fruit and violate the prohibition. No one makes clear many things in the story. It's a very brief account, but very resonant. It seems to explain everything, but it explains it with many blank places.
You talk about how the story has resonated, how it has resonated with different peoples in different time periods, and of course, as you mentioned a moment ago, of different faiths. And I'm curious as to, in looking to that, is there a through line? I mean, is there a baseline, a commonality that those that resonance has?
Well, one baseline would be the attempt to explain how things are. Why did we wind up the way we wind up? Now, there are a variety of different ways of interpreting what the story is telling us, but in all versions, the story has something important to tell us about the way we live now, as well as how things were back at the beginning of time. Whether it's why we're afraid of snakes, or why women experience excruciating pain in childbirth, or lots of other things, the story seems to want to tell you something about the origin of this experience.
You talk about the different stages and tracing the story from its textual creation. And then as the story goes on, when do we see it at its full power of not only how various religions and various people react to it, but the effect that it starts to have on our culture, the effect that it has on visual art, literature, medieval art, and so forth?
It's an interesting question, Joe. I think that the full force of the story begins to be felt only when crucial decision is made. It's made fairly late in terms of the life of the story, though it doesn't seem late to us, but in the 5th century of the Common Era, when particularly powerful and important theologian, St. Augustine, makes the key decision to doctrinal decision to insist that the story be taken as literally true. Before that, there were a variety of ways of interpreting the story, but many people understood the story to be a parable, a teaching tale, a myth. People within the religion itself, rabbis and Christian theologians. But Augustine, not immediately, but eventually in his life, decided, no, the story has to be taken as literally true. These were real people in a real garden with a real snake and a real piece of fruit, which they should not have eaten.
And then it is brought into the Renaissance, and this is when the story becomes transformed and we start to see these artistic creations.
Well, the artistic creations happened in Christianity from the beginning. Judaism and then subsequently Islam have prohibitions on images, but Christianity doesn't, most Christianity in any case. And so already early in the catacombs of Rome, people began to draw, paint Adam and Eve. And it's tremendously tempting to paint them or draw them because it's a wonderful way of depicting naked people. Christians were no longer making images of Venus and Athena or Apollo, but they could do images of naked people. But the naked people that are depicted in medieval representations are, for the most part, depicted as ashamed. That moment in the story, great moment in the story, in which after they eat of the fruit that they're not supposed to eat, they feel ashamed and start covering themselves. So most, not all, but most medieval representations, many, depict Adam and Eve in a state of the deepest shame. And what happens increasingly in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance is that different ways of representing Adam and Eve arise, including representing Adam and Eve as perfectly beautiful, as in their moment of most magnificent, fully realized nakedness.
You write about some of the greatest works of art associated with Adam and Eve, including Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel fresco, The Creation of Adam, and John Milton's Paradise Lost.
What's remarkable about Michelangelo's famous image, and strange really about it, is that celebrated image of God reaching with his finger and touching the prone Adam's finger to spark him into life. And that is a wonderful idea. Of course, it's not the biblical idea. And the biblical idea is that God breathed the breath of life into the clay out of which he made Adam. But Michelangelo, the painter with titanic ambition, depicts what a painter would do, reach out his hand and bring the figure to life. So in some ways, Michelangelo is celebrating, we could say, himself, his own titanic power as a creator. And that's something that actually I think we see from time to time in representations of Adam and Eve, the extent to which the writer or the artist projects himself or herself into the image. But in the case of Milton, though there are thousands and thousands of visual representations of Adam and Eve, there are many fewer representations in poetry. And John Milton, the English poet of the 17th century, did something amazing. It was toward the latter part of his life. Everything was in ruins. He was blind. The revolution he supported had failed. His children hated him. He was had lost his money. He was in danger of being executed. And yet he wrote not simply a poem. He wrote what I believe is the greatest poem in the English language, Paradise Lost, which is the story of Adam and Eve, in which he tried to figure out what they were like, what their relationship was like before the fall.
You have a line in the book, for by the close of Paradise Lost, Adam and Eve had become so real in Milton's imagination that they began to crack open the whole theological apparatus that brought them into being. It is very powerful. You then bring the story to us of how this then collides with the world of science. And talk a little bit about that collision, and then what ultimately happens to the story.
Well, partly the story, you could say, is the lesson is be careful that you might get what you wish for. St. Augustine and the theologians of the Middle Ages wanted Adam and Eve to be understood as literally true. And in the Renaissance, the artists and a writer like Milton developed a kind of technology that made it possible to actually make them seem literally true, to make them seem real. But the trouble is that once they become that real, problems that had always haunted the story begin to become almost unbearable. For example, what does it mean that you're prohibited? You're given one single spectacular prohibition. You can do everything else in paradise, but you can't eat of a particular tree. But that particular tree is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And lots of people from very, very early on noticed that there was a problem in that, because you might think that only if you knew the difference between good and evil would you be able reliably to observe a prohibition. So it's as if there were a kind of twist in the story. But there are ways of trying to explain that or argue what it might mean, but they're interpretive allegorical ways that are much more difficult if you actually see them as real people, like your aunt and uncle, or yourself for that matter. And that began to become more and more disturbing. Or the naming of the animals. Where did Adam get that language? How did he do this? Or even the nakedness. What happened after 1492 is that Europeans began to encounter hundreds of thousands of people who weren't covering themselves. But you were supposed to cover yourself as a condition. All human beings were supposed to feel ashamed of their nakedness. So how to explain this? And these problems began to, should we say, build up all through the 17th and 18th centuries. And then into that current of skepticism or disturbance, into that current came other kinds of evidence, the evidence for the age of the world that began to emerge from the science of geology, where suddenly the number of generations that are listed in the Bible seemed grossly inadequate to the number of generations we know must have occurred from the geological evidence, infinitely more generations than the Bible could account for. It had been thought that the world was created in 4004 before the Common Era, but that date began to seem increasingly risible late last night compared with how old the world actually was, and so forth. And all of this came to a head, of course, in the 19th century when the young Charles Darwin, went on a ship carrying his copy of Milton's Paradise Lost, his favorite poem, with him, and found himself in a world that no longer made sense in terms of the Bible's account.
The title of the book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. Is there ever truly a fall, or do you believe there will always be an inevitable rise to this story?
Well, they, of course, I mean, my title is a bit of a joke, but I mean, they of course, you know, do fall in the story by eating the fruit that they're forbidden from eating. But the story itself begins to lose, for some of the population, by no means all, because the polls suggest that many of our fellow Americans believe still in the literal truth of the story. But for many people who weigh the scientific evidence, there's no possibility of believing in the literal truth of the story. So in that sense, it began increasingly to lose credibility as referring to real people in real time. So that many people, even people who are religious now, interpret the story allegorically or symbolically. But for my purposes, it never completely falls. And it never completely falls because it's a great story. It's an emblem of everything we care about in literature. It's way of asking deep questions, not scientific questions, but deep questions about the nature of existence, and coming up with powerful, resonant ways of suggesting how we became the way we became.
The name of the book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. The book is published by Norton. Stephen Greenblatt, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, the new book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.